Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's the podcast, stupid. Strike up the band!
You can't win an election if you're a bleeding torso.
I think it's a Mandelsonian joke about his size.
Zip it was the expression used by one of them.
That's how we've got that big niche audience. Yes, here we go again then. It's How to Win an Election, your insider's guide to the huge political year ahead. I'm Matt Chorley, joined as ever by New Labour mastermind Peter Mandelson. Polly McKenzie is Policy McKenzie, former Director of Policy for Nick Clegg. And of course, Tory brain box Daniel Finkelstein is here as well. Although not here, all scattered across the four corners of who knows where. Are you all well?
Very well, thanks.
Yep, me and my dog.
Good, good. Pleased to hear it. Yeah, and if you want to get in touch, email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk, or better still, send us a voice note to 033-003-2353. That's 033-003-2353. Like John. In fact, John in Merseyside's got in touch. He sent an email saying, I was just listening to your excellent podcast when Mabel, my three-year-old daughter, picked up my phone, paused the podcast, looked at the photo of the three of you and asked, are you listening to Harry Potter, Hermione and Ron when they are older? John says, I can see the likeness too. I wonder if J.K. Rowling would write a new book, Harry Potter and the Prince of Darkness, maybe. So, Peter, how do you feel? You are the you're the Harry Potter of the setup.
Yeah, no, I'm very excited. This could be a big breakthrough for me, I feel.
You just need someone to give you a scar on your face. I don't know if you know anyone who'd like to do that.
There are plenty, I can assure you. I've made a lot of enemies.
Didn't Tony Blair...
Even in the last couple of weeks.
Didn't Tony Blair have scars on his back? So maybe he could lend you one.
That was because he was trying to reform the public sector.
All right, keep it light, Peter. Daddy, how do you feel about being Ron?
Well, I'm assisted in this by not having read any of the Harry Potter films. I've watched them, and my older son was completely obsessed with it. But I've now sort of forgotten well enough who Ron was that I can treat it as if it's a massive compliment and not worry too much.
But what about you, Polly? You're the Hermione of the gang.
Well, obviously, I'm delighted to be considered cleverer than both of them. I mean, what more could you want? But Matt, I think the question is who you are. And surely the answer is Neville Longbottom, an unprepossessing chap. But in the end, the saviour of us all.
I'll take that. I don't know if that's true or if you're being sarcastic, because I know enough about the three we've discussed and the big chap, Hagrid, who I'm clearly not, because I couldn't grow a beard if I wanted to.
Well, I remember you doing a photo shoot in the Times in your pyjamas once.
Yes.
And there is a scene where Neville, something happens to Neville, he gets petrified whilst wearing his pyjamas. And honestly, I mean, it could be you.
Everybody, by the way, who's works on the Times has at some point been persuaded by the features editor into some embarrassing photo. I've got one that consists of me sitting backwards on one of those chairs like Christine Keeler did. I hasten to say, a pair of shorts on. But apart from that, because I just had a spray tan, I did a feature on having a spray tan. And immediately after this spray tan, I went to 10 Downing Street and sat on David Cameron's white sofa, having been told by the spray tanner that the tan stuff came off. So I remember sitting right on the edge of this sofa, worried that if I touched anything, I'd turn his white sofa completely brown.
If you want to get in touch with any other similar questions or to pass comment on our faces, my face, it does appear on the other podcast on Politics at the Boring Bit. So, you know, if you want to see my face, you'll have to go there and look at that. More sensibly, Ross from Leeds has sent us a voice note. He says he is Labour leaning, but was forced to vote for the Yorkshire Party, in the last two elections, given how dreadfully pathetic the offer was from all three main parties. So this is Ross's question.
Long-time listener, first-time voice noter. I'd like to ask the group about the polls and some of the contradictions in the conclusion that have been drawn. Currently, Labour are roughly 20 points ahead, which is leading to the assumption by many, and it would seem a lot of the Tory MPs who are standing down in their droves, that Labour are on course for a huge majority. Yet others, looking at you, Peter, are still noting a sound of caution that in order to win, Labour needs a bigger swing than that of 1997. So which is it? Thank you all for a very informative and entertaining podcast.
So, Peter, which is it?
Look, if you had a swing at the coming election of the sort of the size we had in 1997, Labour would only get a majority of one. We need a much bigger swing than we had then, because we're starting from a lower base. You see, you can build up what appears to be a big national swing and still be short of an overall majority, because swings can vary considerably from seat to seat. So depending on the distribution of Labour votes between seats and how efficient this is, it could make a huge difference to Labour's majority. But I learned from the past, Matt, and I know that in successive elections going back decades, the size of the shift towards the Conservatives on election day compared to what it was 6 months before has been substantial in every single election. The Conservatives, for whatever reason, catch up. So that, for example, again in 1997, the Tories gained 9 points. You know, Labour's poll lead went from 22 to 13 during the campaign, primarily in the campaign itself. So you can't just rely on what the polls say now and assume that they're going to remain static, that the campaign is not going to make any difference, or that the distribution of votes is going to be efficient, that the swing is going to be reflected in every seat identically, that you may get lots and lots of votes, but if they're not distributed efficiently, you're going to be down. And that's because your votes are not converting as efficiently as you'd like into the number of seats you need to get a majority. So that's why you have to keep fighting for every single vote in every part of the country from now until polling day.
And Danny, the point that Ross makes is that because of the polls, lots of Tories are standing down, presumably because they think they might lose their seats anyway. But the act of doing that probably makes it more likely they're going to lose those seats.
Yeah, so I guess it does. I think that's an effect of the margin. It's definitely an effect, but it's an effect of the margin, I suppose, in most seats. So you will lose a few extra probably as a result of that. But it won't be vast. The big question is whether Peter's right, whether in this period between now and the general election, you do get slight swing back towards the Conservatives, a sort of reversion to the mean, really. And that's what you often see, the votes fluctuate, and then you get a reversion to the mean as you get closer. Look, the argument that will happen is that in 2010, people underestimated the fact that the Conservative Party needed a vast swing. And David Cameron ended up getting one of the largest swings in history and still didn't win a majority. And I think, you know, afterwards we all reflected, well, we hadn't really properly appreciated what size of swing he needed. And you could argue that in that election, the Conservative Party realised Gordon Brown was whole below the waterline, but wasn't able to make people feel comfortable with a Conservative government. And the argument for Peter's position is that's now going to happen in this election. I'm not so sure, really. I've for a long time thought that wouldn't happen. I think Keir Starmer's done just about enough to reassure people. And so while I would say my guess would be a slight reversion to the mean from the current polls, I wouldn't think it would be much. And so I would anticipate quite a large Labour victory.
Polly, obviously the last week, the big news we've had is that Rishi Sunak went to the West Country, went on ITV West Country, said there is not going to be an election on May the 2nd, stealing Peter and Danny of the chance to be right. You seem to have doubled down on the idea he might still end up calling the election in January 2025.
Well, only because I'm the only one who thinks that, really, and I'll feel really smug if it ends up. So, of course, with commentators, they're also playing that kind of game, right? There's a sort of differential risk. What you're really aiming for is looking right or not looking embarrassingly wrong. So Peter is absolutely right to school the Labour Party against any kind of complacency. I mean, my first political memory really is the 1992 election. I stayed up with my dad. I was 11, stayed up with my dad to watch the election, totally in that expectation that Labour was going to win and there was going to be a new change. And in as much as I knew anything about politics, I was, you know, excited, my first ever non-conservative government. And then it didn't happen. And I think it's very much in the sort of Labour sort of myth, history-making story, is that complacency was what one of the things that really did for them during that election. So it doesn't matter if it's true that it might all fall apart. You have to act as if it might fall apart, because acting arrogant will screw you over, and much better to overcorrect to win too much than to, what's the opposite of overcorrect, undercorrect, and slightly.
I don't. So can I say that a number of things? First of all, just to correct you, Matt, I always argued there'd be an October election. What I said was they should go in May, but they wouldn't. So that's just that just to reassert that. And I think that's indeed exactly what's going to happen, October, November, when they should go in May. The whether or not a party is arrogant. See, I don't think that's what happened in 1992. What I think is right is to say that they were complacent because they didn't appreciate the amount of reassurance that was necessary, underestimated. I mean, some people, obviously Peter understood that, Philip Gould understood it, but I don't think they were able to persuade their colleagues that was to do it enough. So the question is whether or not Keir Starmer will keep on reassuring voters that they can that electing a Labour government won't upset the apple cart, really, and whether he appreciates the need to do that all the way to election day. My guess is that he will appreciate that.
Peter, what's your lesson then from 92?
Well, my lesson from 92 is that, you know, the Labour Party can appear to be doing very well, and we did indeed have a polling lead. But what we underestimated or didn't see carefully enough were the number of people who were going from Tories to don't know or won't vote or haven't made up our mind yet. So they weren't actually, the biggest number of defectors was not from Tory to Labour, which you would have thought was the case from just a superficial reading of the poll. And if they're not prepared to come right across to you, but instead go to don't know or won't vote or whatever, they might just go straight back to the original, to their original Tory home when they're faced with the choice on polling day. Now, equally now, Danny may well be right. You know, they may be in the don't know category, haven't made up our mind yet, and then faced with the prospect of another fifth Tory term, conclude that they just cannot face it and the country won't survive, and that they really have to go all the way across to Labour to get a change of government so that we can begin a new story, a new chapter in our national story. And I think Danny may well be right. I hope he's right, that people will decide that that is the case. But all I'm saying to you is that in successive elections, the lessons from those from that past is that the Tories make up ground during a campaign. And that's why we've got to be fighting at the top of our game from now right up until polling day.
The point that you were making, Polly, about everyone sort of just saying lots of things and the hope that some of them turn out to be right. My favourite one, tail end of last week, after Rishi Sunak ruled out the election, the Independent reported that it's going to be on October the 10th. It's revealed it's on October the 10th, the election. I was really like the idea that Rishi Sunak's had his meeting and decided it's October the 10th and then said, make sure somebody tells the Independent.
Matt, I think the date in October will be determined by when the new system, the entry-exit system for between Britain and the European Union, kicks in. This hasn't started yet. And they've got new technology, which for all its sort of superb modern character, nonetheless requires some human being to stood on the border stamping people's passports, and that's going to slow everything up. And therefore, what they're really frightened of, and I discovered this on a campaign visit to Dover and Deal to campaign for Labour's excellent candidate Mike Tapp, is that when that new system kicks in, the government are absolutely scared rigid that there's going to be chaos at the border, cars, lorries, people banked up for miles ahead of the border, and that's not the sort of chaos that they want breaking out right in the middle of a general election campaign. So they'll want to avoid that and go slightly earlier in October than perhaps you think.
There we are. Some top advice. Well, the key thing then, maybe, the Keir Starmer needs to do to seal the deal is get some top celebrities back in the Labour Party. Up next, we discuss the power of celebrity endorsements. What Keir Starmer really needs is Taylor Swift. We'll do that next on How to Win an Election.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yes, it's How to Win an Election with me, Matt Chorley, joined by Peter Mandelson, Polly McKenzie and Daniel Finkelstein. Now, in the run-up to the general election, you know, you need to get everything in order, you need to get your leaflets ready, you need to get your slogans ready, your party political broadcast. But I want to talk today about endorsements, because on both sides of the Atlantic, perhaps the most hotly anticipated endorsement right now is Taylor Swift's expected backing for Joe Biden. Now, on Super Tuesday, a couple of weeks ago, she posted on Instagram that she wanted to remind you guys to vote the people who most represent you into power, but she stopped short of endorsing any party. When Joe Biden was asked about it by late-night host Seth Meyers, this is what the president said.
Can you confirm or deny that there is an active conspiracy between you and Ms. Swift?
Where are you getting this information? Classified.
Classified information?
That's classified
information. You won't share it with us?
I'm not gonna, but I will tell you, she did endorse me in 2020.
She did. I bet you might be wondering. You think it might come around again?
I told you it's classified.
So, Danny, you're a keen follower of American politics, and I assume a keen follower of Taylor Swift. Will this make any difference?
Look, I think endorsements do make a bit of difference. That's why American politicians seek them. they make difference at the margin, in my view, like lots of things. I mean, if you're engaged in a persuasion campaign, I think the best thing to do is to persuade people that people like you might vote for it. So I think it's much better to get peer-to-peer endorsements. But celebrity endorsements, insofar as people attach themselves to the celebrity, do matter. And I've been involved in attempts to get... My favourite attempt was when the Conservative Party tried for its conference to get a bunch of celebrities, and it really struggled. We got Rick Wakeman from Yes. This was in the, like, you know, the 2000s, and he obviously was famous in the 1970s. We got Mike Reed, the DJ, and Mike Yarwood, who was no longer on television. And then when the Labour Party conference came round, they had Nelson Mandela.
I mean, that really is what that really is one up.
And you just had a... Polly, are you waiting for Taylor Swift to endorse Ed Davey?
I don't think he's really her vibe. You know, that's I'm not Swifty, but in general, no, he's much too sensible for Taylor. I think that the celebrity endorsement can be a bit dangerous. I think in the 2010 election, David Cameron had Michael Caine, didn't he?
We are announcing our plans for a national citizens' service. It's a kind of non-military national service.
When they first mentioned this to me, all I heard was national service. And I thought, oh my God, they're bringing it back. I did it myself and it wasn't very good.
But then you've suddenly got a celebrity endorsing a policy they obviously haven't read the briefing about, and then they say something controversial and stupid, and then actually you've spoilt your news cycle because it's all about the fact that, you know, the celebrity doesn't really understand what they're talking about. And then there's also the other story I remember is the Yes to a campaign during the referendum, where that campaign had the endorsement of Benjamin Zephaniah, the poet. And he was on the leaflets they sent to every person in London. But for those who don't know, he's a black poet. They'd taken him off for all of the leaflets sent to everyone outside of London. And the assumption was made that that was because they thought everyone outside of London was racist. And it went down horribly, horribly badly. And again, completely screwed the idea of having a news cycle of famous, nice people last.
And the trouble is that people change their minds. You know, celebrities are almost like normal people. And in 2010, when the Lib Dems were on the up and you were, you know, on the cusp of power, you had, what, Daniel Radcliffe, Colin Firth, you know, big actual proper celebrities, not your Mike Yarwoods, but people who were actually famous at the time. But then within months of you going into coalition and doing exactly what you said you were going to do, which was, you know, trying to exert your power in a coalition, they all sort of turned against you. Daniel Radcliffe said Nick Clegg had become a Tory whipping boy.
Well, maybe he knows more than I knew. I don't think that was actually part of the coalition agreement, not the part that I wrote. I did get to talk to Colin Firth. That was very exciting. I edited a book called Why Liberal Democrat. Now, it says on the spine that it was edited by Danny Alexander, but like, obviously I did all of the work. But anyway, I got to speak to him because he wrote a whole essay endorsing us because of our human rights policy. And interestingly enough, one of the things that we had committed to do was stopping the detention of child asylum seekers. And actually, even though it probably wasn't top of many people's list, it is something that we absolutely insisted on and drove through in government that, you know, really wouldn't have happened without us.
One of the things that's very funny about celebrity endorsements is the way that people get Colin Firth. Obviously, he is an actor, but he played a human rights lawyer in a comedy drama. Didn't Labour once, Peter, get Dr. Legg from EastEnders? He wasn't acting to endorse its policy on the NHS. But this actually is quite shrewd, because what really you're trying to do is create an empathetic relationship between the people, or try to sort of have a subliminal message. I remember that there was always those adverts of garden awnings that were endorsed by John Stalker, the policeman, and I couldn't understand why people would want to buy a garden awning that was endorsed by a policeman. But it turns out that that they'd found out that people were worried that they were going to be ripped off by the people installing their garden awnings, and that's why they had him. So there's all sorts of thoughts have to go into choosing. Well,
very
which
excitingly, we went from Dr. Legg in the 1980s to Jerry Halliwell, Ginger Spice in 2001, and this really excited Tony Blair. He loved the sort of glamour and excitement of a Spice Girl, even though she'd actually been a very strong supporter of Mrs. Thatcher, who Jerry Halliwell had described as the original Spice Girl. But here's the point about her. It soon became very clear, not only that was Jerry Halliwell making a little cameo appearance in an election video of ours, because she had a new album and a new single that she wanted plugging. But she had no intention of voting. She wasn't even registered to vote, as transpired very quickly. I mean, the star that Tony did become very nervous of, and as it transpired with good reason, was Noel Gallagher of Oasis. And when Tony discovered the day before that Noel Gallagher was coming into number 10, he sent staff out to just reassure us that he wasn't going to misbehave. And the record label chief said, no, don't worry, you know, he'll be fine. And he was fine on the day. But some years later, he revealed, or at least claimed, that whilst in number 10 that day, he'd snorted cocaine in a lavatory, one he claimed was the Queen's WC in number 10, which he said he could tell from its velvet seat. I don't know whether this is true or not. I've never seen the velvet-seated loo in number 10, but that's what he claimed shortly before he turned on Tony Blair and sort of started denouncing him rather savagely over the Iraq war.
I had a really odd experience. I had a very odd experience regarding Oasis. I was in the bar of a hotel on holiday when I bumped into this person, started talking to them very politely, and it turned out to be Alan McGee, who was the manager and sort of one of the originators of Oasis and manager of their record label, or I have an exact relationship with them. I'm not completely sure, but I had a perfectly pleasant conversation with him about, you know, what I did for a living and what he did and all that. And then a couple of years later, he claimed on radio that I'd tried to recruit him as a Conservative candidate. I don't know where on earth he got that. And he named me and said that it was the most bizarre thing. I don't know where on earth he got that impression from, because I don't think he would have made a very convincing Conservative MP.
The most exciting celebrity experience I ever had was with Sean Connery. You know, I'd been brought up on James Bond films. They were very much my era. And I regarded him as a completely iconic figure, so that I was very excited when I was told that I had to sign him up to support the government in the pre-legislative referendum over Scotland in 1997. I though couldn't think how on earth I was going to get hold of him. But Jonathan Powell, Tony's chief of staff, his sister-in-law, Carla Powell, knew Sean Connery. For some reason, she used to call him Tiger. I'm not sure why. So I called Tiger, got the telephone number from Carla, and we had a very friendly conversation, and I asked for his help. But during the course of this telephone conversation, he started wondering out loud why such an iconic figure as himself hadn't actually ever received any proper recognition from the country. So I said, I just couldn't understand this, how it'd been overlooked, and that I would mention this oversight, obviously, to the powers that be. And coincidentally, he happened to get a knighthood 2 years later, having come out very strongly for our devolution plans in the referendum.
Polly, there is a risk for this, because actually, if you look at what happened in the Brexit referendum, all of the celebrities, you know, the up-to-date ones rather than the sort of Danny era ones, pretty much were on the Remain side. And actually what the Brexit campaign, the Leave campaign managed to do was sort of turn that into a negative, saying don't be preached to by the multi-millionaire out-of-touch metropolitan elite. You want to, you know, this is a people's uprising. Do you think that actually they're just at the same purchase on British politics of a celebrity? Like, why would I decide how to vote because June Sarpong told me to?
Well, because June Sarpong is awesome, but oddly enough, it's the same people, right? But they're on the exact same shtick in the TV campaign, because again, all the celebrities and Ed Miliband were on the side of Remain, but the No to AV campaign, you know, just absolutely trounced them with this sort of sense that every man was on the side of keeping electoral system the way it was. I think, you know, if you can attract the big star celebrities, it's not just that it attracts the attention of the voters, like that does matter. It's also about just the politicians themselves feeling kind of good. You know, like Peter's super important, right? But he's still excited to meet Sean Connery. That's amazing. I met Toby Jones from Alan Bates versus the Post Office, and also like the Marvel Universe and everything anywhere. I met him last night. He's amazing. Normal human beings meeting celebrities to be fun.
Polly, you know that doesn't count. That doesn't count as a Lib Dem meeting Alan Bates. You know that, don't you?
I know that that doesn't count. I know that it doesn't count.
When I was working on William Hague's speeches, Seb Coe, who was, obviously himself was a celebrity endorsement, who was William's chief of staff, called me up and he said, Danny, we've got a whole series of jokes you've got for this speech that have been written by Ken Dodd. And I had to go through each one of these jokes. Not one of them was actually suitable. And I felt really embarrassed because I was turning down the humour of this great legend, but not one of them was suitable. And actually, I do think in this conversation, we've hit on something important about endorsements. It's not actually just so much that you admire them. You've got to be able to relate to them. And that, I think, I think that's possibly what the endorsements on AV or Brexit didn't capture completely. If someone is completely from another world to you, I don't think their endorsement is as helpful as it might be. Really, what you want to do is to say people like you are voting Conservative or Labour. I think in the 2019 election, the discovery by people in a lot of red wall seats that their neighbours and other people like them were planning to vote Conservative, having never done so, removing the idea that, you know, no, around here we never vote Conservative, was pretty crucial in creating that the support that the Conservative Party got in 2019. So this was not endorsement by famous people, but it was endorsement. So I think that the crucial thing is, are these people like me? Can I relate to them? Can I imagine what they do? And there are some celebrities, you know, and Dr. Legg is a very good example, who kind of do capture that quality, and others who might not.
Danny, why do you think that Jeremy Corbyn in the 2019 election didn't have quite the impact that was needed when he rolled out his biggest endorser, who was the rapper grime artist Stormzy? Yeah. Who went round, you know, my man Jeremy, I dig what he says. I mean, can you imagine that reaching into the parts of the red wall?
It did reach certain people, right?
So, in North London.
So it was interesting. So you'll recall this Red Wedge campaign. I was very concerned about it at the time, its potency. But the Conservative Party have the support of Shirley Bassey, Cilla Black, Jimmy Tarbuck, a range of celebrities with a far greater reach of people feeling these are kind of my entertainers, they're who I relate to. And Labour did win a lot of youth support, but no support in that kind of group. So it's the nature of that celebrity is very important.
I think that's absolutely right. If you get a bunch of lefty actors and alternative comedians, you know, your Ben Eltons and your Lenny Henrys, great people. When the Tories are wheeling out sports stars like Steve Davis and light entertainments like Bob Monkhouse and Kenny Everett and the rest, although he went a bit funny, Kenny Everett, when he suggested we should bomb Russia.
Let's bomb Russia!
The truth is that your Bob Monkhouses have a bigger reach than, you know, than Ben Elton. You know, Ben Elton was endorsing the people, in a sense, who we already had supporting.
You were involved with Neil Kinnock's video, Tracy Ullman.
That was before my time. That was in 1984. That was a year before.
I've never known you answer a question so quickly, actually, Peter. That was before my time.
No. Actually, it was quite good, actually.
I want to ask you all one question. Who is the celebrity today? If you were advising a campaign, it doesn't really matter what party is, or maybe it's the party that you've worked for. Who is the celebrity that you think would reach into the sort of swing voters that we've been talking about? And you're not allowed to say David Attenborough, because everyone will say that. Polly, let's start with you.
I'm going to say Taylor. I want Taylor Swift. We're getting on to Taylor Swift. I think we could bring her over. I think it could go very big.
I'd want Anton Deck.
Okay, interesting. Polly?
Lorraine, obviously. I mean, she's just so cool.
Well, she thought that Peter was rude when she was discussing his comments about Keir Starmer. So, but let's not get bogged down in that again. Let's move on. And we've got another question sent in. This is a voice note from James.
Hi, guys. Who would you put your smart money on to become the next Tory party leader? Suella Braverman, Camus Badenoch, Priti Patel, or Ralph Garnett?
So that was a voice note from James in London. Danny, I suppose this is your party. We should start with you first. Who's your smart money on to be the next Tory leader?
If I'm really smart with money, I'm not going to put my money on that. And it would all be, I think all of it is quite long odds. I think it's very hard to make a judgment. So the first thing you have to work out, which of these people are going to keep their seat? So, for example, you know, a lot of people speculating Penny Mordaunt might be a strong candidate. Well, she may or may not, depending whether or not she kept her seat. An awful lot will depend on things that are quite difficult to work out very near to the election, where who's up and who's down in the immediate response to the election, how the immediate days after the election go in terms of the argument. I don't think the Conservative Party has an immensely strong field. I don't personally think that it will be Suella Braverman. So I guess of those candidates, I would think the most likely of them would be Camille Badenoch. But she clearly has, you know, as well as certain political abilities, without any question, a lot of questions about her ability to perform at the level a leader has to perform at, which is much higher than a cabinet minister in terms of temperament and ability to approach issues. But I guess in that list, the one that you gave me, she's likely. And then beyond that, it's very difficult to know who would be in the next parliament and who might be a candidate. You know, you can't ever in a leadership election rule out Michael Gove trying again, for example, if he's in the next parliament.
Polly, what do you think?
I think it's probably somebody who has really long odds at the moment. It is rarely the people you're talking about before the catastrophe that leads to, you know, the eviction of a leader happens. The people who we're talking about now will have peaked too soon. And of course, there's always I guess the possibility still speculated around that the Conservative Party gets knocked down to 50 seats. Nigel Farage somehow joins and, you know, reverse takeover through something or other. But I'd like to hope that it would be a moderate. You know, whether that is Tom Tugendhat, I don't know, somebody more of my generation, Laura Trott, she's probably, you know, further away from it. That, you know, there are centrists and moderates still in this Conservative Party, and there will be this a real sort of crisis of direction for them, assuming that they lose the general election, at which point they will have to decide between the centre and the right. And I'm just going to hope.
I think given the realignment that's underway in the Conservative Party, they're definitely heading in the direction of Alf Garnett. But if you were faced in the Conservative Party by the women that you've identified, Matt, if this was the old Conservative Party, I think you'd have the, you know, the men in grey suits coming back and saying none of the above. not because they're women. I mean, actually, the Conservative Party's got a much better grip on gender equality at the top of their party than my own party has. But because they would just see they don't have the capability, they don't have the appeal, they're not up to being leader of the party. And I think in those circumstances, they would look for a stopgap, rather as they did in 1963 when Macmillan stood down and they turned to the 14th Earl of Hume, Alec Hume, who they got out of the House of Lords to fight a by-election to take over the leadership of the Conservative Party. I think the obvious candidate to do that now is David Cameron. I think they would turn to David Cameron, free up some seats that he could fight a by-election, leave the Lords, enter the Commons, and then he'd try and sort them out before, so as to give them a breathing space before somebody more appropriate could line up for the leadership further down the course. So my money's on Dave.
Peter, you're not the first great political mastermind to suggest this. It was a few weeks ago that someone wrote on Twitter, I'm calling it now, David Cameron. There's a plot to bring David Cameron back as Tory leader, and that was Nadine Dorris. So you're in really good company. Danny, so we're facing now, Danny, the prospect of what, Michael Gove and David Cameron in the next leadership contest.
What this demonstrates, because the question was where would the smart money go? What this demonstrates is how incredibly hard this is to call. So that is an extremely low probability happening. Both of those two options, but they're not zero possibilities. I think David Cameron is probably quite close to zero, but it's not a zero possibility. So the Conservative Party, a lot depends on the size of this victory. So it depends on our earlier discussion, whether people feel the Conservative Party is out for 10 years, whether people feel there's a chance the Labour Party, the Labour government might not last, and the Conservative Party might have a chance to come back. It will, so there are people in the Conservative Party who are future leaders. Some of them will and some of them will not be in the next parliament. Claire Coutinho is certainly someone who can be leader of the Conservative Party at some point. I very much respect and like Alex Chalk. But I think it'll be hard to hold Cheltenham at the next election. So an awful lot will depend
on who's left.
Who is in Parliament and when?
I mean, Danny, you obviously know David Cameron well. He's obviously enjoying himself being Foreign Secretary. You think there's a tiny part of him that might want to come back properly as leader?
I think it's difficult. I think also some of the issues that, were not so difficult in coming back as Foreign Secretary, including the whole Green Seal thing, might be more difficult when he came back. But the other problem, the Conservative Party's got to sort out who it wants in its coalition, whether it kind of wants to be the sort of party that David Cameron was able to lead in 2010. I feel that after the next general election, it may conclude that it doesn't want to do that, and it may go off searching a rather different coalition, which I think, is a search that will end up being fruitless and won't work. But I'm not sure it'll turn back in that direction. That quickly. This is all, assuming as we are that it doesn't come quite close at the next election.
So what Dan is saying is that the kaleidoscope will have to go through quite a series of vote losing turns before they come to their senses and decide they want to win again.
So one person we haven't mentioned in this discussion is James Cleverly, he might well run from a position whereby he can gain support from more than one wing of the party. And that's quite always a strong position from which to run for the leadership. Whether he's somebody who can then change the Conservative Party into an electable body again may not be the question, actually, the Conservative Party is answering. It may be looking for somebody who can give it at least, a solid period in opposition. And he may turn out to be that. So there are a number of options, all of which at the moment have kind of significant but small percentage chances, and we could sort of go on doing that for ages, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the appeal of James Cleverly is that he's a bit of a blank canvas, and so everyone from different wings of the Conservative Party can write up on him what they want and project their views onto him without really him having to decide either way what he really thinks and what he really represents. So it may be that your stopgap is a blank canvas.
Nobody's mentioned Boris Johnson. Is that a realistic thing?
No.
We won't be in Parliament.
He's not even in Parliament. I mean, ludicrous.
He could come back. He could come back. Somebody will stand down, Polly, and just make way for him if he thinks he has a chance of taking over the party again.
There we are. That's a great question, anyway, from James. We've covered a lot of ground there. James from London sent his WhatsApp voice note to 033-003-2353. You can email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. Massive thanks, as ever, to Polly McKenzie, Peter Madison and Daniel Finkstein. I'm Matt Shawley, and that was How to Win an Election.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.